treated the reproductive organs, resulting in decreased fertility when today's child becomes tomorrow's adult, and damage to the liver, which interferes with cholesterol metabolism and increases risk for obesity, for diabetes, for heart disease, and stroke.
Dr. Landrigan, we just have 30 seconds. Plastics and climate change are both born of the fossil fuel industry. Talk about how they're connected.
Well, they both originate from fossil fuels, and the other connection is that plastic production is energy intensive. It liberates 2.4 gigatons of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere every year. That's more CO2 than comes out of Brazil or Russia.
And finally, what you're hoping to come out of the Lancet report in 20 seconds, if you would.
We need two big things out of the negotiations in Geneva. Firstly, a cap on global plastic production because the current trend is not sustainable. And secondly, strict regulation of the more than 16,000 chemicals in plastics, which currently are responsible for most of plastics' known hazards to human health.
I want to thank you for being with us, Dr. Philip Landrigan, director of the Global Observatory on Planetary Health at Boston College. We'll link to your piece in the Lancet Countdown on Health and Plastics. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Our website's democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland.
Support for KBOO comes from our members and from Amplify PDX, presenting their community block party on August 9th at Open Signal. The event will include tabling, live music performances, and workshops. Tickets and information at opensignalpdx.org.
Well, there sure are a lot of crises these days, but one that doesn't really get much attention is the one that may be the biggest in the long term, and that is the food crisis, feeding a hungry world. I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
He's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
We're all too familiar with the constant news from Gaza that people are dying of starvation. There's also Sudan. But not in the headlines is the reality that in 2023, 733 million people faced hunger and 2.3 billion were moderately or severely food insecure. And this in a world of great unprecedented abundance. 8 men have more money than 4 billion people combined. In the face of this incredible disparity, our guest today, author Richard J. Sexton, a distinguished professor of agricultural and resource economics at the University of California, Davis, Sexton posits that, amazingly, we are purposely doing things to cause less food to be produced. What? In the 21st century, despite our ancient operating system based on scarcity, might there actually be enough to go around? Is it time to ditch that belief in scarcity? And are measures initiated by the environmental movement, though clearly well-intentioned, perhaps a contributing factor to worsening the picture? Could it be? What's the role of the trend of buying locally produced food? And what about the consolidation of farming into the hands of a few giant agribusinesses? What about the vestiges of colonialism when it comes to fair access to food? A lot of questions we'll get to. Can it even be done? Will we have enough food to feed our growing world population in the coming decades and avoid sharply escalating food prices? Might Trump's love affair with tariffs affect food availability worldwide? Our guest is Richard Sexton, who spent his life in agriculture, from growing up and working on his family's small dairy farm and crop farm in central Minnesota, to his career as a professor of the Department of Agriculture and Resource Economics. His new book, which we'll discuss, is called Food Fight: Misguided Policies, Supply Challenges, and the Impending Struggle to Feed a Hungry World. The book asks how we can construct a food system that forestalls future hunger and environmental degradation. Well, there's a lot to talk about, Professor Sexton. Thank you for being with us and keeping democracy alive.
It is my great pleasure, Bert. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. You come from a background of a small family farm. As you know, those are disappearing. The downtowns of small cities throughout the Midwest are largely hollowed out. What has been the effect of the big shift from the old American identity of small family farms to giant corporate agribusiness? What has been the effect of that?
Well, first of all, Bert, the average farm size in the U.S. has basically increased through history, and so the small farm that I grew up on in central Minnesota is really a vestige of the past, at least as it pertains to dairy production. But in fact, most of these farms, albeit that they're larger today, they're still family owned. I mean, they may have formed corporations just for tax purposes and liability purposes and things like that, but they're still the farming in this country is still held by families. And really, the reason that the farm size has grown is that the larger farms are more efficient. That's the basic principle of economies of scale. And one of the big things that I talk about in the book is that natural consolidation that's occurred in this country in the quest for greater efficiency hasn't occurred in a lot of parts of the world. Even, for example, China. China's a powerhouse now, as we know, in many aspects of the economy, but most of China's agriculture is still on very tiny plots of 1 or 2 hectares, and that's 3 or 4 acres roughly speaking, or possibly even less, because under the Chinese system, the farmers don't have secure rights to the property that they farm. The property is actually owned and held by villages, and so farmers cannot buy and sell property as they can in this country. In which, if they were able to do that, and this is true in other parts of the world too, many parts of Africa, for example, the property rights are insecure, so the farms stay small, fragmented, and inefficient, and that's a big problem for world food production moving forward.
So even though China is huge, the population is huge, and it's a real political powerhouse, they're not so efficient either, even though they're, allegedly Marxist.
Yeah, that's a real problem. They have made the property rights somewhat more secure just within the last decade by issuing what they call land certificates, which enables then you to rent land but not sell it. But just think about that from the perspective of someone who would like to consolidate some farms to reach a minimum efficient scale. Yes, you can rent, but then things that you do to upgrade the property and so forth, install irrigation and things like that, you're not going to do that on rental property because the next year it could be rented out to somebody else. So the ability to rent is not the same thing as the ability to sell, and that's a big problem there. It's a big problem in many parts of Africa and so forth.
So the profit margin is still hugely important. I mean, people, complain about capitalism all over the place, but it does enable jobs to grow, and the profit motive. If people are denied that profit motive, how does that affect food production?
Well, not in a favorable way, to be sure, right? Because the quest for profits is also a quest for efficiency, to be able to do things better and less costly. And then, if you're not efficient, if you're too small relative to the efficient scale and so forth, you're not going to do very well. And that would have been the case. In fact, it was the case for my family farm back in my younger days. I mean, we just simply couldn't compete with the bigger, more efficient dairies. And now in that part of the country where I grew up, there's no dairies there anymore, right? Because they just couldn't compete with the bigger operations. But that's the market at work. We don't have to like it, and we can do things to constrain it. But when it comes to the most basic aspect for human survival, namely food production, we need to think twice before we put the brakes on food production. But that's what we've been doing in this country, Europe, many parts of the world, and that's one of the things that inspired me to write the book.
Putting the brakes on food production, that sounds nuts, quite frankly. Who is your target audience for this? And tell us about this, putting the brakes on food production.
Well, my target audience is pretty simple, Bert. It's people that are interested in food, right? And that's really should be all of us. Yeah. But it's very easy in this country to take it for granted. But we know during COVID, food prices rose rather dramatically. That they've leveled off now; they haven't come down, and people noticed. They cared. They didn't like it. And in terms of the brakes on food production, sure, I can give you some great examples. And again, it's mostly happening in the richest countries, U.S. and Europe. What about just taking productive land out of production? So about 7% of U.S. ag lands is now in conservation reserve. The Europeans want to remove 10% of their agricultural lands by 2030. So that's, just simply taking land out of production purposefully is a big deal. And there's some of your listeners are saying now, well, yeah, but that's a good thing. They're doing that to enhance conservation.
Right.
But here's the big thing. And this is something, we may come back to maybe multiple times in our conversation. Mm-hmm. The most efficient places to produce food based upon all the statistics are certainly the U.S., and in many parts, Europe's a very efficient producer as well. So when the efficient producers take land out purposefully, what happens is that more land goes into production elsewhere in the world, most likely in places where it's less efficient. That's what the researchers call indirect land use conversion. And it's about the worst thing you can do for the environment is to take out virgin forests and till the land. Immense releases of carbon. Those forests are carbon sinks. You chop them down in the Amazon or Malaysia or Indonesia, and massive releases of carbon, no longer carbon sinks. Nobody disputes that about the worst thing you can do for the environment is take those virgin lands out and put them into agriculture. But as soon as the efficient producers take land out, another great example is biofuels.
Yes.
Amazingly. It's stunning to me. But about 25% of U.S. agricultural lands now, based on productivity potential, it's not total acres, but many of the most productive acres are being grown in corn and soybeans to produce ethanol and to produce diesel fuel. So that's land taken out of food production, and so less food's being produced here. And then much evidence shows that this is true. It creates land use conversion in other parts of the world. And so the whole idea that, yeah, this stuff is good for the environment, that's not right. It's not right once you consider the indirect land use conversion.
Interesting. Yeah, there was quite a push for biofuels a few years ago, but it seems to be more people are questioning the use of corn and soybeans, being drained off to go to biofuels when people need food. And you talked about not cutting down, virgin forests. In South America, for example, there's been a long, oftentimes violent struggle between those who want to conserve the natural land and those who want to convert it to farming. There's a lot of hungry people in the world, especially in South Africa and well, not just Africa, but South America as well. What about that struggle there? I mean, the farmers who want to use that land, can they be convinced, should they be convinced not to use it? And what about the production of food then?
Yeah, well, those are great points. But part of the message of the book, Food Fight, is that in some sense we can have our cake and eat it too. Yeah. If we focus our production on getting more off an existing land base. So that's what they call intensification, getting more off an existing land base, but expanding the land base, that's what they call extensification. And that's the bad thing, but that's what we're causing. So for example, I mean, everybody knows that probably the world's greatest remaining rainforest is in Brazil.
Yes.
But now, amazingly, nearly half of the soy, you know, so if you produce soybeans, it's crushed into meal or oil, and almost, well, it's crushed into meal and oil, so you get both out of when you crush a bushel of soybeans. But nearly half of the oil produced in the U.S. now is being used to produce diesel fuel. In my home state of California here, about 60% of the diesel fuel. So if if you've got a vehicle that burns diesel, 60% chance, or 60% of it is going to be made from biofuels, and we're deforesting the Amazon in the process. And there's probably some of your listeners would say, no, that's not true. They won't buy soybeans from the Amazon. But what's in fact happened in Brazil is that the cattle country where they were raising cattle has been displaced by the soybeans, and the cattle have moved into the Amazon. And so, yes, the indirect land use change has created by our biofuel policies has contributed to deforestation in Brazil, in the Amazon, and elsewhere in the world. And there go your environmental benefits right out the window.
Wow. Yeah, so it can be both and. It doesn't have to be either or. That's an interesting concept, and I think that's true for many different issues. Now, in terms of efficiency, pesticides greatly increase yields. People are concerned about pesticides. They don't want pesticides on their food. And there's people were worried a lot about GMOs a few years ago, and I think that's been proven to be not harmful. But what about pesticides? They increase yields. They're pretty efficient. What about that?
Well, they do increase yields, and they do increase efficiency. And so the key is to have the right standards in place, and certainly in this country we do, to make sure that any pesticide residues are below levels that the health experts would consider to raise a concern. And you mentioned the GMOs, and what you said is exactly right. The fears of them when they were first introduced, they were called Frankenfoods and so forth. Those are completely unfounded. There's zero evidence of any harms from GMO foods. But yet to this day, they're still largely banned in Europe. They're banned in many parts of Africa because Africa is a big trading partner with Europe. So if you want to sell foods to Europe, they can't be GMO. And even in Russia, there's significant restrictions on GMOs. And there's no scientific basis for doing that. And Bert, if I can circle back to one thing that said on biofuels, which was really true, and a big message of Food Fight is that once we put policies in place, they're not readily reversed. And you're exactly correct with biofuels that the bloom is off the environmental rope. And the environmentalists get it now that that biofuels are not the environmental panacea they were believed to be. But guess what? There's huge swaths of the rural economies in the U.S. that are largely built around ethanol. Corn production, the ethanol plants are right there. They're significant employers in these rural communities. And they're not going to go away. The mandates for use of biofuel are for them to increase, and the biofuel industry is a powerful lobby.
Yes.
Significant and powerful Midwestern senators and Congress people, and they want more, not less. And so, we're all burning now E10, 10% ethanol in our gas. They want E15 and more from there. So, a big thing is, if in 2040 or 2050, whenever we say, "Oh my God," food prices are escalating and so forth, we've got to open up the spigot. It's nothing you can do overnight because these things get embedded and they don't get readily reversed.
Yeah, I wonder when I pull up and buy gas for my car, which does get pretty good mileage. It always says 10% ethanol in there, and yeah, I try not to contribute to global warming as much as I can, and help the big oil interests, which are so powerful politically in this country. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Professor Richard Sexton, Professor of Agricultural and Resource Economics at the University of California. And his new book is called Food Fight: Misguided Policies, Supply Challenges, and the Impending Struggle to Feed a Hungry World. Speaking of a hungry world, in terms of foreign relations and world trade, I never imagined an American president would intentionally start a trade war. But this guy did just that. And he seems to be having fun watching the world react to his constantly changing, impulsive-driven threats of tariffs. What do you see as the effect on worldwide food production and distribution of new tariffs?
Well, it's not good, to be sure, because one of the fundamental messages of Food Fight is we need to produce food in the most efficient places in the world to produce it. And for a large number of commodities, that's right here in the good old USA. So we're the world's biggest producer of corn, no question, the most efficient producer. Big producers and exporters of lots of other things, and we're the most efficient producers for almost all of these crops. But where we're not efficient, well, then we should be importing it. And that's the time-honored principle of economics is called comparative advantage. Countries should specialize in producing the products where they have a comparative advantage, right? So the U.S. could be the most efficient producers of maybe 100 different commodities, but the idea in terms of maximizing the size of the pie is that everybody produces where they're relatively efficient. And of course, if you're having a trade war and high tariffs, that diminishes in extreme cases eliminates the ability to trade foods across countries. And so if a country can't get its soybeans and from the U.S., well, maybe they're going to get them from Brazil or someplace like that, or maybe they have to start their own production, which is going to be less efficient, which is going to involve land use change. And so yes, you're totally right that the idea of producing in the most efficient places to get as much food as cheaply as we can is undermined significantly by imposing trade barriers. We need products to move across countries so that they're being produced in the most efficient places and then traded freely. So, yes, free trade is an important part of this puzzle.
Wow. Yeah, I tend to disagree with a lot of his policies, I must say. And this past Saturday, I was at my local farmer's market. It was lovely. The idea of buying local is exceptionally popular right now. Consumers want healthy food as free as possible from various chemicals. Sometimes they overreact. To accomplish that, there is a drive now to buy organic agriculture from local farms. How does this drive affect food production in the big picture?
Well, I mean, first of all, I want to make it clear that if someone wants to grow strawberries or tomatoes or something, on the outskirts or in rural areas around cities and come in and sell their produce at farmers markets or food stands or food boxes, however they're able to market it. Mm-hmm. They're probably not going to get into the big stores, but that's great. I mean, but it's just an interesting part of the food system. It's not contributing in any significant way to feeding the world. It's barely a blip on the screen, but I don't want to be portrayed as somebody to say that you if you want to do that, and if you want to grow that type of food, and if people want to buy it, more power to them. But yeah, it's not an answer to food production. And Food Fight has a whole chapter on organic, and I know this is again goring some people's oxes, but the truth is what it is. And hundreds of studies document the yield decrement due to growing organic. And on commercial tests, it's on the order of about 30 to 45%. So every time we convert an acre from conventional to organic, we get a third to, you know, to two-fifths less production off that acre than if we had kept it conventional. That's a fact. Nobody can dispute it. It's been established in countless studies for countless crops. And so then it's the same old story. It's indirect land use change coming back to us, right? So that if, you know, if we're, and a great example, Bert, is that the European Union, as part of their farm to fork strategy, wants to be 25% of its land, European Union lands, mm-hmm. inorganic by 2030. Now, that's going to result in less food production. Nobody can dispute that. And if Europe produces less food, the U.S. produces less food because they're, through public policies, converting more and more of it to organic, then it's a guarantee that land is going to come into production elsewhere in the world where it's probably less efficient and then causes this deforestation and the significant environmental harms associated with it. So, yeah, organic is fun. A lot of people like it. They think it's safer. They think it's but they think it's healthier. There's really no scientific evidence to support those things. And the one thing that there is scientific evidence and an abundance of it, uh-huh. is that there's drastically lower yields, and that's a problem in terms of food production.
What about our new Secretary of Health and Human Resources, Junior Kennedy? What's his? You know, he's very, it seems to be, knee-jerk against any kind of chemicals at all. Is he a threat to increased food production that we need?
Well, yeah, he has some strong attitudes, to be sure. I mean, I haven't seen him do things yet that are going to significantly affect food production. I mean, he has a campaign against ultra-processed foods and so forth. And, I honestly don't know what the scientific basis for that is. But, once it comes off the farm, you know, we do all kinds of things to it through the food system, yeah. as we know. And so far, I've not seen him propose things that would cause us to produce significantly less food. But, you know, if he comes after pesticide applications and so forth, then, then we start to run into trouble. And then, you know, again, one of the real ironies is that the GM foods were designed to make us use less pesticides, in particular, you know, because they've, uh-huh. they've built a built-in resistance to things like worms and so forth, where heretofore they had to spray to try to kill the worms. So, that's again part of the irony is that GM corn and soybeans actually cause less pesticides to be produced, and they're banned in a lot of parts of the world.
Wow, that's really interesting. I certainly didn't put those two together, but that's what you're here for, to explain stuff, and you've done a lot of research on it. How long did it take you to write this book? It's pretty, really in-depth stuff that is a really important issue.
Well, thank you for saying that, but it's the product of a long career spent doing this. So when I actually sat down to write it, it took me a few months to do it. But, it was really assembling the pieces of a puzzle, yeah. that, some of the pieces had been put in place by my own work, some of the pieces put in place by my colleagues' work, and so forth. So it was just kind of looking out at this big picture and saying, here's something we're really not thinking about. We're worried about right. all sorts of aspects about food production. It's emissions, it's contributions to climate change, some of the inequities associated with food production. but we're not focusing on the big picture itself, which is producing enough food to keep prices low, to make food accessible, and to avoid rising hunger and malnutrition. And so, you know, once I had the puzzle pieces, it only took me a few months to assemble them, and that became the book.
Yeah, and I notice, I mean, there is, of course, discrepancy between people who have disposable wealth and everybody else who don't. And families, if they can afford it, do try to buy food that has not been treated with pesticides, is not ultra-processed. But what about that in terms of feeding the world? And what about the population of the world? Was it 7 billion now or something?
No, it's over 8 billion. Oh, it's about 8.2, and it's going to rise, although the UN, which really sort of has the role as the official population forecaster, sort of scaled down its forecast for population growth. But no, the UN is projecting it's going to get up above 10 million, I think 10.4 million, excuse me, I said
billions.
Billions, 10.4 billion. By about 2080, and then they expect it to level off. Of course, that's so far out in the future that, you know, who knows? And the UN even admits that they don't know. They put confidence intervals around these numbers, and their confidence interval has a gap of 28%, right? So they recognize that there's a chance that they're off by in that 10.4 billion by 28%, but. Yeah, there's going to be more of us to feed, and you know, and a big part of the book is saying, you know, there's not only just going to be more of us to feed, but people are going to be demanding more food, and a big piece of the equation that people don't tend to think about, but it's definitely true, is that incomes rise in the poorer parts of the world, which again is where lots and lots of the world's population lives.
Right.
They're going to move away from traditional staples like rice, right, and maize or corn, tubers, and they're going to demand more efficient, more diversified diets, including much more meats, much more dairy, yes, products. And then there's no denying that to consume meats and dairy, and hey, I like meats and dairy, and so again, I'm not criticizing any of us at all that consume them, but they are not efficient ways to produce food for humans. It's much more efficient to grow the food directly for humans than rather to feed it to animals who then produce the human food. And there's dispute among the scientists as to how big this gap is. Some think it's really big, some think it's less big, but that's a big part of this, that we will, as a global society, be wanting more of those types of foods as incomes rise. And that just takes more total food production, more land and food, and so forth. And you can miss that if you're just talking about calories. It's not just calories; it's what comprises those calories that really represents the challenge to feeding the world. And so then, you know, one of the things people do is they say, "Well, okay, we'll just eat less. We'll just eat less meat as a global society." But people are going to want to eat more, not less. And then they say, well, okay, we'll tax meat. Well, there really aren't any meat taxes now, and I think it's because politicians are afraid to do it. People don't like that type of a tax. And so, you know, some of the solutions to coerce us into eating less meat are a pretty tough sell.
Yeah, I don't think we can be coerced. More and more people, you know, they look at killing sentient beings, and you know, the ill effects of the meat industry on the environment. People are trying to get off the meat eating habit. What about that in our context of having enough food for people? And what about protein? People need protein, do they not?
Well, absolutely they do, although there are other sources, but yeah, and that's one of the issues you know, if you're looking at income growth in some of the poor parts of the world, and of course, remember, 35% of the world's population live in two countries, India and China, and they've both grown very rapidly. I mean, the Chinese now consume a lot of meat. They're the largest pork producer and consumer in the world. The Indians don't consume that much meat. Primarily, it's a cultural and religious thing, but right. they're starting to consume more as, you know, the younger generation is exposed to social media and things like that. And so meat consumption in the world is going up, not down. And even in this country, it's interesting, Bert, because meat consumption went down over this century for a while, but it's now started to come back up. Yeah, I mean, we sort of know the health issues about, you know, consuming too much fatty meats and so forth. So probably a lot of us could afford and be better off consuming less meat.
Right.
But you know, as a global society, the impetus is going to be to consume more meats and more dairy as incomes rise. And so, you know, the people at the World Bank, the UN, all these big policymakers say, yeah, we'll just get the world to consume less meat, less dairy moving forward. Well, good luck to you.
If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're talking about something that, you know, is sort of off the radar, there's so many other crises. We're talking about the food crisis. Our guest today is author Richard Sexton, who's written a new book called Food Fight: Misguided Policies, Supply Challenges, and the Impending Struggle to Feed a Hungry World. And we rarely do things looking at the long term. I mean, you know, the first Earth Day, I think, was in 1970. And how much have we done on that? Not a heck of a lot. But one of the issues, I would imagine, is waste. A tremendous amount of food goes to waste. It's not even composted to produce future agricultural products. I mean, I do it myself, but, you know, in a big city, that's hard to do. You say efforts to waste less food are unlikely to be effective. That surprises me. If we want to have enough food for the world, shouldn't there be a crash program to cut way down on food going to waste? Something led by a big government?
Yeah, well, that's a great topic and a great question to be raised, and a timely spot in our interview, right? Because if you know, to the extent that policymakers, world leaders are sort of even aware of the impending problems that we're going to face to feed a hungry world, there's basically two stock answers that are given. One is to eat less meat. We just talked about that. And two is to waste less food, and so it's good that we talk about that now. So the first of all, the official statistics break it up into two components. What they call food loss is what occurs from the farm up to retail, and then actually food waste is what happens at retail and in the homes. And there's a lot of statistics that say it's upwards of a third of the total possible food production is lost or wasted. And so, yeah, that certainly seems like the low-hanging fruit in terms of getting more foods produced and eaten. But, yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of problems. And incidentally, the Europeans, the U.S., Biden administration set this goal. And the UN, all kinds of major governments or world bodies have said, hey, we're going to cut it by half. You know, they just come in and said by half. I mean, what's magical about a half, I don't know. But they've all said it. We're going to cut it by a half. I think that's completely pie in the sky. And, you know, I won't waste a lot of time on this, but a couple of the key things are this. I mean, first of all, what the researchers call food loss. So, you know, there might be researchers going behind harvesters on a farm, say here in California, and looking at what they leave behind, and you know, they'll collect it and say, hey, this could be food too, and so this is food loss. The harvesters came through and they didn't get it all, and so that's food loss. But I mean, here's just a simple example. I mean, it was something we all know. So what we call hearts of romaine lettuce is just the inner part of the romaine lettuce plant, right? And so it excludes the external leaves. And so the harvester, that's going to be hand harvested, and the harvesters are just going to chop off those leaves in the process. That's the most efficient way to do it. And then, Bert, as you said, it goes back into the soil. It gets composted right into the soil. So that's the best place to get at the heart of the of the romaine. Yep. And but researchers will come behind and pick up those leaves and say, hey, that's food too. And you just wasted a lot of, or you just lost a lot of food. But it's not something that could be marketed. If those external leaves on the romaine had any market value that exceeded the cost of getting them to market, of course they would be marketed, but they don't. So that's one big part of the problem, is that they're overstating it, you know, on the basis that I just said. And then, you know, the second thing, and we're all part and parcel of this, I know I am, is that, you know, particularly here where food is relatively cheap, you know, and you're at the store, you'd rather buy too much than too little, right? You don't want to run out and have to make another trip to the store.
Right.
Yeah, so we all buy a little bit too much, and then we probably waste it.
Yes, we do.
A little bit. And then here's a very interesting thing. If you look at the statistics across the world, you might say, well, okay, U.S. is a rich country. We can afford to buy a little extra food, so we're probably the biggest wasters. Well, we're right up there. But the poorest places are also big wasters.
Oh, interesting.
Primarily because they don't have, in a lot of parts of the world, they don't have refrigeration. So they can't store and preserve food the way that we can. So as their incomes grow, now China almost overnight went from very little refrigeration to now there's nearly 100% refrigeration in China. But then as the incomes grow, then... you're going to waste more for that basis, because again, you'd rather have a little bit too much than too little. So yeah, do I think we can waste less? I do. Do I think we can cut it in half? I absolutely do not.
Right.
And we should all seek to waste less. And one of the things that's going to help in that regard is better labeling of expiration dates, right? Because typically expiration dates that we read on food products that we buy are not the last day that it's safe to use, but it's a sell-by date.
And then
you could still use it for some days thereafter. So I think there's things we can do in that regard, but cutting it in half, that's just a pipe dream.
Yeah, it's just not realistic. One of the things that I find interesting, you talk about retailers, they're a big part of the food production problems and opportunities. What about the retailers? They don't have a huge markup. What about them?
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean, the profit margin as a percentage of sales in food retail is... very, very low, just 1 or 2%.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's easy to vilify these big retailers. And that's, you know, that's kind of a reflexive reaction, as we're going to criticize somebody that's because they're big. But, you know, the biggest food retailer in this country, the biggest food retailer in the world is Walmart. And, Walmart didn't sell food at all. Walmart existed in the 1980s as just a discounter. And they moved into food about 1985, and over the next 40 years now, have become the world's largest food retailer. And they have ruthlessly cut costs out of the system, really forced their competitors to basically adopt Walmart's procurement and supply chain systems. And so, if you buy at Walmart, you will pay less than if you buy at almost any other place. I had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago with reference to the New York mayoral race, where the candidate.
I was going to ask about that. Yes.
it's a funny thing. I thought, but because the candidate Mamdani wants to have publicly run grocery stores, so.
Right.
New York is one of two major cities in the U.S., L.A. being the other, that keeps Walmart out. So there's no Walmarts in New York City. And so I just said, hey, What if you let Walmart in instead? Because there's lots of scientific evidence, lots of studies done that on average food prices are about 15% less in a Walmart than elsewhere. And so if you want to save New Yorkers, I just did a rough calculation, about $2,000 a year, let Walmart in. And so that was a fun thing to throw into that whole equation.
Well, what about Mondani? He's attracted a lot of attention, got some mojo working for him, that's for sure. And he talks about municipally owned. Without having a profit necessarily involved, no profit at all, might not this help make food more accessible to the poorest people? And couldn't this be done at a state level? Is that just totally unrealistic?
Well, to my mind, it is. I mean, he has a lot of ideas, but I think the idea of publicly run groceries is probably about the worst of them. I mean, first of all, I mean, they would have no... I mean, and again, you're right that the motive to make a profit, to earn some income, that really, you know, drives these efficiency motivations and so forth that we've been talking about in this interview. But, you know, if I mean his initial plan is to put one in each of the five boroughs of New York, and then to go on from there. And if I remember from the op-ed, I think the cost was on the order of $300 million or something like that. But those stores would then have no procurement network, no supply chains, no warehouse structure. It would be a nightmare. It would be a disaster. I mean, they would be not able to compete on the basis of price at all with the commercial stores. So then what would happen is that, you know, there would have to be diversion of public resources, more and more subsidies to make them be, you know, remotely competitive in price. And so you'd be draining the city's treasury to keep these stores going. And so, amidst a lot of the other things that that he's advocating that tend to make their way into the cable news more than publicly run grocery stores, that's a really bad idea.
How do you really feel? The population most in danger of serious hunger, I think, are from the global south. Now, the era of colonialism, where the, you know, Western countries, Europe and the United States, the era of colonialism is nearing an end, I hope. But I sense that the global South is rising. What can they do to ensure food sufficiency for themselves? And are they doing it?
Well, they are doing it, but, you know, there's significant barriers, and we already talked about one of the most significant, which is being able to operate food production at an efficient scale. And so, yeah, you're not going to get there with these 1 or 2 hectare, or, you know, multiply it by 2 roughly, or 3 or 4 acre farms. So, you know, so they need to, you know, put in place systems that remove the barriers to expanding farms and increasing production. You know, a big problem in a lot of those countries is they say, oh, well, if the people come off the farms, they'll come into the cities, and then we're going to have problems, dealing with poverty in the cities and so forth. So that, you know, from a policymaker perspective, they'd rather have people on these farms, sure, but you're condemning them to a life of relative poverty and amidst hard work, and you're not doing the city dwellers any favors either, because you're not able to produce food efficiently. And so, yes, there's no doubt that that increased productivity in those parts of the world could help to solve the food problem. But again, the big thing is, you know, if you're not at the minimum efficient scale of operation, you can't use lots of these technologies that are scale intensive. So much of the productivity growth in agriculture has been in terms of equipment, machinery, for planting, for harvesting, and so forth. that stuff doesn't, you're not going to be able to have that type of technology. You're not going to be able to operate it on these small plots that exist in lots of parts of the world. And so, you know, so they're mired in this small scale, inefficient food production. And, you know, say, well, you know, then they need to remove those barriers. And in fact, they do. But, you know, they're basically embedded in the political structure of those countries. Right. So if it's written right into the Ethiopian constitution, for example, that the land belongs to the public. Right. So there's really no private land holding in a country like that. And without that, there's no real basis for production to evolve, to become efficient.
And if I recall correctly, there was real starvation in Ethiopia a few years ago. Yeah.
Yes.
If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're talking about an aspect that doesn't normally get talked about. The book we're talking about is Food Fight, Misguided Policy, Supply Challenges, and the Impending Struggle to Feed a Hungry World. And we're speaking with its author, Professor Richard Sexton. And, you know, we mentioned a little bit about ultra-processed foods. They're a lot cheaper. If people can afford it, they try to stay away from such alleged food. These ultra-processed foods, I imagine they yield big sales for agribusiness at far less cost than foods that have not been heavily processed. It's more efficient. But what about efficiency? Is that really being driven by cost reduction? Is that the best way to measure food production, just efficiency? I mean, don't we want healthy food?
Well, sure we do. And so, you know, when I'm talking about efficiency, I'm really talking about efficiency in farm production. Then, you know, what happens beyond the farm gate is largely, you know, agribusiness trying to, you know, cater to consumers' wishes and preferences. And again, you know, it's a fact that busy American households on average like convenience, right? And so something you can just rip open a package and you know, just eat it on the spot, or, you know, throw something in the oven without, you know, doing a lot of chopping and so forth. I mean, mm-hmm. that appeals to the American consumer. I'm not saying it's the most healthy way to eat. It probably is not the most healthy way to eat. I think that it's clear that we should, in, you know, consume more fresh foods, fruits and vegetables and so forth. So it's not the best, to be sure. But on the other hand, it's not a conspiracy on the part of agribusiness to force these things upon us. It's agribusiness trying to supply what people want. Uh-huh. And that's simplicity and convenience. And, you know, if it is unhealthy, if Bobby Kennedy is right, that's a problem in terms of American health. I mean, I'm an economist, not a health researcher. But yeah, then we should A, inform people, and B, you know, do things to get less of that. So I'm not saying that he's wrong, but, you know, I am saying that it's not agribusiness pushing this stuff down our throats. It's agribusiness giving us what we want. Right. We might not know what we really need, but we know what we want. And so, you know, more power to him if he teaches us that, you know, some of these things that we crave aren't good for us and we should do better. So I'm fine with that. And that's not really going to impact that much, you know, the food production and so forth, because yeah, we can get it direct to people with less processing and handling. That's great. So when I say efficient, I'm really talking about getting food off the land into the supply chain.
The supply chain, I wonder how that can be made more efficient. I mean, people buy food from all over the world. I mean, it's a global economy now. And, you know, the pay for farmers in, you know, what are currently third world countries is pretty low. But, you know, at least they're providing some jobs, I suppose. What about that international trade aspect of meeting the impending food crisis?
Well, it brings us back to what we talked about a little bit earlier, the, you know, the tariffs and, you know, and the Trump administration's efforts to, you know, raise tariffs or at least get trade deals in place. So Yeah, we need, in terms of food production and getting food to the places that need it and getting it produced in the most efficient places, we need free trade, right? So even amidst some of the trade barriers, there's the whole world is connected with by trade. And so, you know, that comes back to saying, you know, if we do things in the U.S. and the Europeans do things to cause less food to be produced, there'll be more food produced elsewhere, because these markets are all interconnected. And that's, you know, then that brings us back to the 10,000 pound element, the bull in the china shop, whatever sort of term we want to use, we might want to feel good about our environmental bona fides here in the U.S. I know the Europeans want to feel good about theirs, and they say, yeah, we're going to go more organic, we're going to take land out of production and so on and so forth. But yeah, what they're not picking up on is that they're going to cause more land to go into production in parts of the world where it probably shouldn't be going into production. And such as, I'll give you one very quick example. I have a very good PhD student right now using aerial data for Indonesia and Malaysia, showing how those two countries have been deforested to plant palm plantations. And so why is all this palm going in? Well, it's going in because about half of soybean production in the U.S. is going to go for diesel fuel, not being used for cooking oil. So all of a sudden, it creates this vast expansion of demand for cooking oil. And so it's being supplied by palm oil, and that's deforesting these major rainforest areas there in Southeast Asia at great, great harm to the environment.
And to the people there, I imagine. I mean,
Well, and it certainly it could be, right? Because it's, I was literally at a conference earlier this week where she was presenting just some of this photographic evidence over just the last couple of decades, and you could see, you know, say in 2000, the photograph just showed virgin forests, and then gradually over the next 20 or so years, they became replaced, and you could very vividly see these rows of palm trees that had been planted to produce palm oil taking their place.
Well, it's one thing for individuals to try to do something. We can do something, but it takes, I mean, there's so many issues involved, supply and demand. What about, what can governments do? What about the United Nations, for example? I mean, as we mentioned before, the first Earth Day was a long time ago, yet very little has been done. Are there any examples where governments have actually taken measures to avoid future problems?
Well, sadly, no, and that's kind of what Food Fight is all about. And so, the driving force is that, yes, the big countries, the rich countries, are doing things to produce less food. If we circle back to the beginning of our talk, they're just actively taking land out of production. And no, the UN, the World Bank aren't helping. Those are political organizations. They write a lot about food. Literally, the UN just has a new, I mean, I saw it today, so it's literally hot off the presses. They put out a report every year on the state of food security in the world. And there's a little bit of good news in it, because they actually say that the hunger dropped a little bit from the number you said at the outset. That was the 23 number, and now we got a 24 number, and it's dropped a little bit, and that's great. But, you know, it's going to fluctuate from year to year. We're not, you know, worried so much year to year, but what is going to be the trends over time. But, you know, those organizations are dependent upon funding by governments from across the world, and they don't want to rock the cart. And so, I mean, Food Fight documents just significant nonsense coming out in these in publications from these types of entities, things that are objectively false, but nonetheless that they're that they're saying. And I mean, I literally at this conference that I mentioned, I was talking to a colleague who is very well positioned within these world bodies, and just simply said, yeah, they're afraid to, they're not going to take on any of these countries because they're the major funders of the UN or the World Bank. And so, no, they're not helping. And that's a sad thing in and of itself, simply because, you know, they're not, I mean, they may know what needs to happen, but they're afraid to say what needs to happen.
And they're certainly afraid to do it. Well, of all the crises that are happening, this is a big one. It's going to get tougher probably over time. The book we've been discussing is called Food Fight, Misguided Policies, Supply Challenges, and the Impending Struggle to Feed a Healthy World. Struggle is a key word here, and Food Fight is the name of the book. Our guest today has been Richard J. Sexton. Thank you so much for being with us today, and boy, let's hope we can talk to our politicians, to our elected leaders, to, hey, pay attention to this. Thank you.
Yep, that's thank you for having me. And yeah, that's a great concluding message, is that, let's get food production back on the table, and, at least before we're thinking about all kinds of policies to make us produce less food, let's take that into account, that, that if we're going to enact things that cause less food to be produced, that should at least be part of the equation.
You would think, but then again, I don't know how decisions are often made. Hey, thank you so much for being with us, Professor Sexton. Thank you. Big, big issue.
It is my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And there's enough to go around of all the good things in this life. And there's enough to go around. And if not, then you can share mine.
If you enjoyed that discussion, don't miss a single show. Subscribe. It's all free. And if you find the information valuable, your friends probably do too. Ask them to also subscribe. It's on Apple, Spotify, Substack, Progressive Radio Network, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and of course, the website, keepingdemocracyalive.com. Thanks very much.
You're tuned into listener support.